The only person I got a picture with, because Sean punked us, he got out of that sushi place in a hurry, was Panzer. Panzer and I had a wonderful time. And then we were like, where'd Sean go? And he was gone. But you've been traveling for like 2 months.
How was it?
So
how was the event? Was it good?
I had a great time.
The Sendlane event, it was awesome. A lot of really smart people in a room together talking. I think the podcast went well. But I did Irish goodbye that wedding or that dinner we were at. I was like, I'm getting the out of here. It was so loud. There was like 12 people. I couldn't talk to anybody. So
at one point I'm 4 feet away from Sean and I can't hear a word he's saying.
We call it the French exit. That Irish goodbye thing. It must be one of these Canadian things, but it's like I'm certain that it's called the French exit. But yeah, he's like slowly back out of room.
I love the idea that Canada has taken a common phrase and made a French version of it for everything.
We're Sean, but as a country.
That's a scary thought. I bet it has a very large military presence. It's episode 24 of the Operators Podcast. We got all the all-stars here today. We got Matt, we got Mike, we got me. There is no Jason. We kicked him off the podcast. He is no longer an operator. Found out he was faking his numbers. Just joking. He'll be back here next week. He actually got stuck on a bus. I'll tell that story when he's on.
He's not here because he's on a bus.
Yeah, which is very funny. So if you're listening, please tweet at Jason, ask him how the bus was. We're just going to talk building conglomerates, consumer brands. We're talking Thrasio, and then we go real, D2C therapy hour. So,
all right, boys, where do we want to go today? I got some that we can get into, but we've just finished talking to Sharoon from Fulfill. I do want to talk personalization because I know both of you guys do a bunch of this. And I think we could go deeper. It's one of those topics that I actually think we can go deeper and we're not missing much with Panzer because I don't think Panzer does any personalization.
No personalization.
We could do any topic without Panzer and go pretty deep. Am I right, guys?
Dude, let's do cooking. He's chirping cooking every episode. Time. Let's go.
Yeah, let's talk cooking. Because he just, did you see his text message? Every time I text the guy, I get some shot back about Canada. Right? Yeah, I asked him, which branding agency did you use, Jason? And he's like, oh, these guys. He's like, they were great, except two of them are Canadian. I'm like, really, man? That's the opportunity? So yeah, let's talk cooking.
You know, I think a really good one would be Thrasio.
Thrasio and personalization. I love that. Let's do a doubleheader. Thrasio and personalization.
Well, why don't we talk about Thrasio? Because I know in the chat and separately, like we've talked about roll-ups and holdcos and like all this stuff. And we have friends that actually do this really well. So I think there's like a whole other episode that we can do on the holdco model. But Sean, why don't you give us like the Thrasio, what's just got announced, because we dropped it in the chat, and then give us your take on it. Then maybe, Mike, you can follow it up, and I'll see if I have any thoughts at all.
Yeah, I think everybody here has a personal story involving Thrasio, right? Like they were making a name for themselves in the Amazon space. My VP of Amazon sold a company to Thrasio. I think he was acquisition number 3. So, I mean, what they were doing was raising a ton of money, buying Amazon FBA brands, consolidating them, and they saw an arbitrage play. They said, hey, right now, companies on the public stock market are trading for a minimum of 8x EBITDA. I can buy these assets for 4x EBITDA, and I can buy as many of them as possible, as quickly as possible, before other people raise money to get into the space. And that was... They actually started pre-COVID, right? They had a huge spike during COVID. So right place, right time, got a ton of money. And famously, they raised, I think, $3 billion. Now, what has happened recently is they've had executive turnover for the past 18 months. I believe CFOs have left, COOs has left, and they've replaced their CEO with a new president. So the founding team, there's a couple people left, but there's been a lot of turnover. And I've heard through the grapevine that there's been some accounting mistakes that led to them having a adjusted EBITDA of positive to a massive loss in one of the years. And now the breaking news is they've just hired some advisors, and those advisors are famous for guiding people through bankruptcy. So it doesn't look great now. Allegedly, all of this
a mistake, and you're never going to believe this, but it made us profitable when we weren't. But it was a mistake.
Yeah,
honest mistake.
Now, the one thing I want to highlight. Marty said this in chat. Yes, they famously raised $3 billion. I believe $2 billion was debt, and it was debt on a convertible rate, meaning the debt was at 2% and then it went to 15%, which is what debt currently trades at for businesses. And if you know anything about servicing debt, the debt payment on 15%, it's just astronomically high.
Oh my gosh.
Like all of their cash.
Well,
goes
it's $300
to
million
debt.
Dollars a year, and right? Let's say the number. Am I doing the math right? $300 million a year is 15%.
Yeah, $2 billion, 15%. If it's like a, you know, mez debt-ish kind of like rate, you know,
how can any
15%.
Business... So, in e-commerce, I mean, what e-commerce business do you guys know that could service $300 million in interest payments? I don't know.
Hexclash.
Off the top of my head.
Jason, yeah. That's where he's supposed to start talking.
Yeah. And I just want to talk real quick, servicing debt. That is paying the interest payments. You're not touching the principal, right? You are just making your, there's no debt relief in sight. Rates aren't going to come down. No one wants to refinance that debt. So you end up going into a structured bankruptcy where you restructure the debt in some way and you continue operations. Traditionally, it was a Chapter 11 bankruptcy or a Chapter 14 bankruptcy compared to a Chapter 7 where you just shut the business down, right? So I think Thrasio will exist for years and years to come. They have a ton of brands, a ton of assets, but they are in a pickle right now. And Bill from chat also said publicly on Twitter, so I'm not doxing him, all equity is probably worthless, and he's probably right about that. So if you have options or shares in Thrasio, outsider looking in, I wouldn't buy those. So Mike, you have personal connections as well.
So
yeah, Mike,
I've
what's
got
your thoughts,
all
man?
Kinds of interesting thoughts here. I mean, I think the first thing that needs to be said, and this has been discussed some on Twitter, it's been discussed privately, is that the entire aggregator, you know, investment thesis was flawed kind of from the beginning. The idea was that you can go and kind of create this, like Sean said, arbitrage, where you can go get capital cheap, you can buy things at lower multiples, and by stacking them together, you can get this bigger multiple. But there's two main reasons why it was flawed. The first is the only exit path that was ever going to be available, ever, was public markets. Because no company, no brand wants to acquire this kind of toy box of random things that you've thrown together, right? Like we've got a carrot peeler, and we've got a back massager, and we've got dog bowls, and you can buy all of it. It's like, who wants that? Nobody wants that. So the whole idea was the public markets are open. We can raise a bunch of money. We can try and hit the window and get it out to the public market. If the public markets are closed, the aggregator model on its face is just like fundamentally will not work. The second piece was there was this idea that somehow there were these, quote unquote synergies that you were going to unlock. But it turns out that that is not true at all. Can you save a little bit on back of the office functions, your logistics, your accounting? Can, one accountant run the books for the dog bowls and the carrot peelers and everything else? Yes, they can. The problem is all of your main leadership. And so I will not share the person. I talked to the CEO of an aggregator the last 2 weeks, and this is almost verbatim what he said to me. He said, the problem is myself and my top people, none of us can focus on one category. And so we can't really drive the kind of results we want to with any of our brands because we're splitting our thoughts across several different brands. There's no ability to focus. So anything that you pick up in the, like, you know, hypothetical synergies and that, hey, we need two accountants instead of four, you lose because you're not able to understand the categories that you're operating in at the same level of nuance that your competitors are. Your product development is not as fast as your competitors. And that lack of focus makes it pretty much a foregone conclusion that you are going to over time lose. So now these aggregators are in a really tough spot because the markets are closed and they've got to figure out how to try and extract some value out of this. And I can say this, there's going to be a lot of assets that move around, a lot of assets that move around, and a lot of them are going to move around at distressed prices. And the aggregators that might be able to somehow salvage a W out of this are going to be the ones that shed a bunch of assets, refocus on their very best brand, and grow that brand. The other story I have with Thrasio is like number one asset is actually something my brother and I created. It's a pillow called the Beckham Hotel Collection pillow, and that's their very best asset. And so maybe
it's still one of my favorite Beckham stories.
Maybe it's coming home, like, baby. Maybe now is the time that it's coming back home. I'm sitting here eagerly awaiting the next restructuring piece of information because I'm if anybody listening to this is in charge of assets at Thrasio, I'm a willing buyer. Hit me up. Send me a message.
Mike, make a public offer. How much you're willing to pay for that right now?
I'm willing to pay 2x annual gross profit on that pillow today. I will find the money. You maybe could talk me up to 2.5. That's the price I would pay today. But honestly, guys, I think that that's going to be the market. Things are going to get really distressed. And this whole, like, things are going to be moving for 5, 6, 7, like, that's not going to happen. And it's certainly not going to happen when there's for the non-strategic, the things that don't have omni-channel distribution, like, people are going to be really cautious.
Yep.
Okay. Mike said one of the smartest things I've ever heard on this podcast. And Matt, I know you have thoughts, but let's talk about the category problem of aggregators, because that's actually a take I've never heard before. And there's a reason why General Mills sells food. And there's a reason why Johnson & Johnson sells health products. And there's a reason why VF Corp sells clothes. There is category synergy. And you lose all synergy when you add in too many categories. And yep. Like, I've never thought about that, but it's super right. That, like,
this was sort of like what I was getting at last time, right? When you asked, like, how can I possibly run two brands? And it's, in my mind, it's like, it's the same customer. One's just older and younger than, it's the exact same customer. And then it's also the same problem set. It's like, I'm just thinking about waste all the time. Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. But if you were running a tech company, which you could argue that Pillowcase is, right? Or like Lomi, either one of those could fall into different categories, but you unite them under, you know, a zero waste goal. And it's like, yep. Oh, that's the category you're in.
That's how it makes sense. Even then, like, I will say the thing that makes it easier to run multiple is, like, both companies with how we launched them, at least, not how they're scaling, but definitely both brands leveraged this, like, creative and paid media machine that we have. Mm-hmm. Right. So, like, that's the common place to deploy leverage. You know, and I know we have friends that have, like, multiple brands that they operate. And it's just that they find these places where it's like, look, we have secret sauce. We do this over and over again. And you can kind of plug, like, a not any product, but like a lot of product or a lot of brands into sort of their machine. Where I do completely agree with Mike, and I think it is brilliant, is, like, we're talking about aggregating, like, a carrot peeler and a dog bowl and, like, all these random things on Amazon. They weren't even brands. Mm-hmm. They're literally, like, Amazon private label arbitrage. Like, they're not even brands. Like, let's just call it what it is. Like, to call them a brand is doing the word brand a disservice. And that's a dirty word on its own.
But I'll just say that if it was just carrot peelers and dog bowls, it'd be fine. But no, it's vacuums and it's sunscreen.
Oh my God. Yeah, they're everywhere, right? Like they're not even just in the home. It'd be one thing to build a thesis and say like, we're going to just own the home. You know, right. that's a separate thing.
Yeah. And that's what I'm getting at is that like, there's actually no category focus under any lens.
Yep.
And that just creates like, you have no idea what you're doing. Right. Like,
right.
You can't become an expert in sunscreen because it's 1% of your business.
The thesis was that the arbitrage was we can buy things at 3x EBITDA and we can put it together and sell it for 6. And so it's all around valuation.
Yes, 2 plus 2 is 10. It was like
exactly
private equity math.
The point you're making, Matt, I think is a really good point, which is how do you drive more value on Amazon? How do you grow on Amazon? And that's in a category, you launch a lot of products. And so having a good water bottle development pipeline is very different than having a good, you know, whatever sunscreen development pipeline. And very little of the muscles that you use in being great at making water bottles necessarily cross-apply to being able to make great sunscreen. And so I think you're making a good point where there is synergy. It's where there's a core process that's at the very center of creating value and you're able to apply it in multiple different ways. So one of the things I wanted to mention here is this is something that every generation has to learn for itself in its own unique way. We were not doing business in the 80s, but like, let me give you a name, RJR Nabisco. You guys know what that is? It's a defunct company. RJ Reynolds, which was a tobacco company, bought Nabisco. And it turned out in the 80s, there was a bunch of this stuff. Peter Lynch, who's one of the better investors of all time, called this diversification, which was basically you'd get these American conglomerates. You know, there's some crazy ones out there. Airlines deciding to go and buy pet companies, you know, and things like that, where they didn't think about category at all. And we know how that ended. You know, history told us like it was a terrible idea and it's become fairly common. It was fairly, you know, well-known wisdom that you don't do this. But every generation has to learn the same. You know, it's like history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. This is to me like history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
Yeah, and look, I think the to me when I see Thrasio and like the whole thing, it was a financial exercise. It was not a let's build a great consumer business exercise. This was financial engineering at its extreme, and it was a grift. Like this is just greed. Yep. This is straight up like we think we can package a whole, this is like the subprime mortgage crisis of e-commerce. Let's package a bunch of up. No offense to your pillow, Mike, but like a whole bunch of up. And like we're just going to like dump it on the public markets and let them be the final bag holder. This is very different. So like if you're listening to this or you're watching this is very different from the holdco approach. Where like we have friends that do this, right? Where they do run multiple brands. They buy them, they build them. That's not a grift. These are people who are like very good at building consumer brands.
Although it's
Matt,
worth saying,
I
and we should have
you completely.
We need Bill on the show because Bill is literally going through the process of deconstructing a holdco down to a single brand. And if you ask him about it,
Bill.
If you ask him about it, Bill's like, my life is so much better. This makes so much more sense. And so even some of the people who have done it semi-successfully would say, it doesn't make sense, you know? So, and we should have him on and hear his perspective. It does depend.
Yeah. Sean, what were you going to say?
I think if you care and love a brand enough and you acquire other brands in a category, it can totally make sense. But we're talking about single digit brands, maybe. You get to teens, right? Like LVMH owns 55 brands. Thrasio bought 55 brands in a quarter. Like
right.
They were buying hundreds of brands. And it's like, yeah. LVMH in a great year with their PE arm, with everything, might make 10 bets. And they're worth $400 billion with like $20 billion of operating profit. Like they're just...
Mm-hmm. This is my thing. Like, I think that if the thesis for a holdco, I was actually talking to Bill, but Bill and I were messaging on this really like 2 days ago. LVMH, right? They have a thesis that is not money. Money matters, right? But like the thesis isn't I'm going to financial engineer a whole bunch of shit together and make it work somehow, right? Like LVMH is like their luxury. Everything they do is luxury. They service a customer, you know, and they just want to continue to buy and build brands that service a customer. So I think, like, can you do this? Totally. It's going to take a long ass time. You're going to have to be really patient, and you're going to need a thesis beyond I'm here to just make more money. Like, that's not good enough on its own.
Yeah. And it's soulless. That like that ends up being true American greed. Right. And it's why European conglomerates win every time when it comes to shit like this.
So, I mean, there's so many of these holdcos and these conglomerates around the world that do work, but they have characteristics that I think are really worth studying. Right. And I really do think we should do an episode where we bring on, maybe it's a Bill, guys, we got to bring Roman on. Can we just talk about that? Like, let's bring Roman on. If we're going to talk holdco and like multiple brands, Roman all day long. You know, so it's super dual, or I mean, Todd will never do it, but like Roman will definitely do it. So I think, like, for your people listening, I wouldn't be scared. I mean, I definitely don't think you should start with like a vision of owning a lot of brands. I almost think that you need to be a little bit masochistic. Like, consumer is hard. We've talked about this. Like, you really need to love consumer if you're going to go into like, I want to build lots of brands. It is 99% of the time for most founders, you should just be building one. It's a lot more fun. You can focus. You can build something more. Your probability of success will be so much higher than trying to build multiple. You know, I do think there are people though that should be that have what it takes and have a desire and all the ingredients that like they can absolutely go out and build multiple.
Guys, everyone on the podcast uses Northbeam, okay? Like, I use Fulfill. I'm trying to invest in Sendlane, and I use Northbeam. I'm the trifecta here. Why do we use Northbeam? Well, we're going to Q4, and if you spend a lot of money on paid media, right? So I'm talking probably multiple millions on Facebook in a month in November. You need a source of truth reporting hourly to accurately pivot budgets and campaign spend. And that one feature alone, my whole paid media team logs into it, my whole creative team logs into it, and they can see which ads are driving sales, you know, creative, whatever, on an independent basis with real-time data, and then pivot budgets accordingly. And in a month like November, you can end up saving 80 grand in an hour or something crazy, right? So it's a great time to use Northbeam going into Q4. It takes a learning curve. You better sign up early because you don't want to be trying to learn how to do it in the Wednesday before Black Friday. It won't be any value to you then. You have to be integrated into the system. You need data. You need to learn how it works. I think they actually have a mastermind coming up next week. And if this, you're listening to this past next week, whenever that date might be, just find Austin on Twitter, hit him up, and he'll do a one-on-one demo with you to make sure you understand how Northbeam works. So thank you, Northbeam, for being a sponsor. They also have a mixed media modeling tool, which this only applies for the big boys in chat. If you're spending $10 million a month, you need a mixed media modeling tool. And if I'm the first guy to tell you that, how the fuck did you get to $10 million a month in spend? Like, I'm too dumb for you to take advice from me. But that is the next level. Attribution tool first, then mixed media modeling, and Northbeam can carry you through that.
I think there's two reasons why I generally am hesitant about the idea of a holdco, because we've had some opportunities where assets attractively priced have been offered to us. I know the same has been true of you, Sean. And here's my two reasons. The first reason is the moment you start acquiring other little pieces, you're distracting your team and you're kind of waving the white flag about going as big as you can with your flagship brand. You're kind of saying, hey, we can't necessarily grow the flagship brand as much as we want to. Like, If we start acquiring things, I think we're capping where Simple Modern can go, and that doesn't make sense to me. The second thing, though, is that usually what you want to do over time is diversify, right? Like 99% of my worth is in water bottles. 99% of your worth, Matt's in trash, you know, and waste management of some sort. Sean, 99% of yours is around wallets. Like, I don't get more diversified by buying a consumer brand in a different category, I don't think. You get a little bit of protection by being in a different category, but you're still in consumer, right? Like, if discretionary income gets, you know, slammed, it doesn't matter if I'm in pets and water bottles, I'm going to get slammed twice. If I really want to diversify, don't do that by going and getting a pet brand. Do that by getting in something like a very disparate asset class, not something else in consumer.
Sean, I want to hear what you had to say, and I got a comment I want to make to Mike.
I was just going to, I'm going to go on a tangent, so please make your comment.
So Mike, I think what you just said is really important for people to hear, that like, it's better off to take one company as far as it can go than to try to like, than to get distracted. I think that that's like very true, with one caveat. And I don't think this is talked about enough, especially in consumer. There are upper bounds to most brands and most companies. There is such thing as the ideal size for a business. Like, not every consumer product company is going to be a 9-figure, 10-figure business. They're just not, right? And sometimes, like, if you've got a brand or a product, you're like, look, it's going to be a $20 million a year business, and that's kind of its sweet spot. Run it there. Don't try to turn it into 50 or 100, you know? And that's why, like, this game is very much about finding your own path up the mountain, and like, there's lots of ways to do this. We're just three dudes talking right now about like options and our opinions and our experience, but there's so many ways to do this. And I think that there's like, it's just to be said that there is no like one right way. And you have to get good as a founder in this game, like especially in consumer, you really got to get good at reading the tea leaves.
Yeah.
It's got to look like, you have to see your own business. You have to see the market. You got to see it all.
The main point that I'd want to make, I agree with everything you said, Matt, is the main point I'd make is for leaders, for talented people, the research says the biggest danger to us is that we really fall into shiny object syndrome, that we just kind of whatever's new, whatever's fresh, whatever's challenging, like we tend to gravitate towards that thing. Even in my business, like we have items that we sell millions of. Like, let's say I sell 5 million of this water bottle, but I can put 80% of my mind share, 90% of my mind share on new products and what's in the new product pipeline. You know, the easiest way to grow my distribution by 1 million units, it's to take the water bottle that I'm selling 5 million of and to sell 6 million of. That is, you know, statistically, that is infinitely easier than finding 1 million units of new distribution and new products. And so what this is kind of a self-critique. I'm kind of preaching to myself here that a lot of times the biggest enemy of the business is myself and my interest gravitating towards just whatever shiny and new and challenging.
Totally. Sean.
Everyone listening should just hit rewind 15 seconds and listen to that 4 or 5 times, because I am the most guilty of that. Like, and I'm going to tell you guys my story about acquiring and launching multiple brands, because Ridge owns 4 different brands right now, right? And I never bring them up. I never talk about them. They're never in my revenue numbers. They're just little fun projects we run. One of them is a content company, everydaycarry.com, that we talk about. And that is a whole team integrated in my Slack, writing shit for me. I bought that because I thought it would be fun, right? We own a bunch of other brands. We have, you know, different gear brands or whatever else. They all do single million, couple million, whatever. But this Q4, I'm launching a new brand. Like, I'm totally doing that. Like, that's already like in the pipeline. And we're the only reason we're doing that is because I have an impossible drive to continue to do new shit. And if I do it to Ridge, I could hurt the business. So it's like, it's like a forced play zone I have to operate in. And it's bad.
I'm no different, Sean. I'm like, my business partner and I are, we're absolutely going to be acquiring more brands, like for sure. We both love, like we really like consumer, both of us. And it's, to me, it's just like, I don't want to do anything else. Right. Like in over time, you know, I there are certain things like I really admire, like, you know, the Berkshire Hathaways, and you know, you guys have heard me say this, like I really do look up to like the European conglomerates, these holdcos that have been around a long time. Right. So like for me, it's definitely part of it, but I'm with Sean on this, Mike. I think the key thing, and I really want everybody to hear it, is like most businesses die from indigestion, not starvation, and that they're trying to do too much, you know, and it's usually the entrepreneur, right? So like kudos for you, Mike, for even, self-diagnosing and being self-aware enough. And I think Sean, like what you're saying is, I actually don't have any criticism with it. I'm guilty of it too, but it's because you're being intentional. You're saying like, no, I'm going to launch another brand. I want to, I like this. Well, it's
and what Sean's saying
it's
is great.
Not for greed.
It keeps you engaged in Ridge that you're getting to do those things. So there's this phrase that we use in Simple Modern, know yourself to lead yourself. We took it from some consulting that we did with a local organization that we really liked. But if you think about it, know yourself to lead yourself. Know what how you're wired, what you need, what your motivations are, and then you can make good decisions to lead yourself. Sean, you have a motor and a desire that if you're not getting to do new projects, you're eventually going to be like, I've got to go. Like, I can't run Ridge anymore, right? But because you're able to scratch that itch with these side projects, you can still be a really effective CEO. And the point I would just make is, like, for everybody listening to this, understanding your motives is so much of leading yourself and being honest with yourself. Matt, you want to go and acquire 20 brands because you have the money to do it and you just really like the idea? That's fine. That's part of the benefit that comes from running a successful business is you get to choose what you do. Both you guys, like we get to choose. But don't, the trick is don't allow yourself to create a narrative that's not true about why you're doing it. You know, and this is where it's dangerous.
Oh man. You know what? The number one I see that I think is just complete horseshit, and you've already called it out, is this concept of diversification.
Yeah,
it's like, well, I want 10 businesses to diversify myself, like diversify my risk. And you know, like let's be honest, like most entrepreneurs, and I don't even know if I'm capable of it yet, but like most entrepreneurs, you can't run 10 businesses, not effectively, like not on your own. So unless you are the kind of entrepreneur, you are like literally the kind of person who knows how to build team and structure and like has done this before in one company at scale. So like you've actually like constructed the org, you're not going to be successful building 10 companies. You're actually not diversifying risk. You're creating more risk by running more companies because it's your first time. You don't even know what it's like to have 100 employees. What are you doing building 10 businesses?
Yeah, great point. Especially when you're not rich yet. Like that's the whole thing is that Ridge can buy and build launch brands because I allow myself to lose $3 million a year. And it's like, if all of it went to zero, all of the shit I'm doing, I'm like, whatever. It's like, move on, next project. Mm-hmm. But, you know, Mike brought up, are you better off just doubling down and growing your business? He's like, I sell 5 million of something. I should just sell 6 million of something. And you have to have a strong internal team who can keep focused on that objective while you go try to plant the next tree. Right. Yep. And like, that's what, and like, I'll make a big Twitter post with a new brand we're launching and I'll tell you guys about it. But like, it is us getting into a category that Ridge has no authority in, but we're going to try to use Ridge as a, you know, a catapult to launch us into a category that I think has longer legs, right? That could just have more LTV built into it. And like, that is the idea. That's why I'm doing it. It is trying to save us from an existential risk, but I probably over justify that because I want to do it. Right. Like that's, it's, I find it
and there's,
fun.
There's two differences it, here. Like Sean, what you're doing is creating something, which is a little bit, it's more asymmetric. You're saying we're going to try something where we're creating this brand and you're a pioneer. I think all three of us are probably like pioneers. It's like, we can go out to the frontier where it's scary for most people. We can kind of get a vision of what could be. We can, you know, kind of forge out and try and push out the frontier. And that's what you're trying to do with this new brand. You're trying to do something that it may not work. The odds are probably against it working, but if it works, it could create a lot of value. And you're primarily the one that's leading out in that. And you've got a team behind you that can, you know, take care of everything while you're out there on the frontier. That's like one model. And then there's a different model where it's like, I'm going to go out and buy assets, buy brands that are established and bring them in. And that's a pretty different model as well. And I do think in general, like when you're a pioneer, it makes sense to be a pioneer. So anyway, it depends on how you're situated, but it's funny, this episode, we didn't think we were going to probably go this long on it, but I think it's actually one of the more interesting conversations we're having because it really gets into the human element of running a business. The reality is running a business is not a spreadsheet exercise. It's a psychological exercise, and it does matter how the founder or the CEO is wired. It does matter what it takes to keep them engaged. It does matter like how, like an example from my business, I have a lot of very talented people under me. And those people are hungry and they want to grow and they want to advance. And I have to think about leading the company in terms of how do I provide options for them. And so I might run the company differently because of the personalities in the company. And this is how the sausage really gets made.
Before we did this episode, we were actually on with Jeroen from Fulfill. And because, like, you know, we got to learn, it's not genuine for us to have sponsors if we don't know anything about them, because it's hard to recommend. Like, you're listening to this show, you want to know that who we are recommending, we actually believe in. And I'm actually excited to do an episode with this guy, because he's like, he clearly knows his shit. But look, Fulfill, I'm stoked to have them as a sponsor, simply because what he said to me before the episode really hit home. When I asked him, like, what is the sweet spot for somebody to work with you? Right? Like, when is a brand a good client for Fulfill? And he immediately jumped into the complexity of a business. And I know that all of us as hosts on the show, we admire this. And we really appreciate it, because, like, every single brand, we talk about it all the time. We talked about this episode, like, there's so many ways to grow a brand. And that usually comes with some amount of complexity at some size. And size isn't the determinator for working with a Fulfill. And I really appreciated that perspective that he had. And, you know, we're going to talk personalization. You can talk about order volumes. Like, Fulfill is purpose built for D2C. After talking to him, I really get that now. So I have no problem recommending him.
Matt, a really interesting thing is he immediately said who shouldn't work for him. I think we should, like,
yep.
He's like, if you're a mattress company doing $10 million a year off of one website, he's like, I don't use Fulfill.
He's like, you can't have value to your life. Which, like, how nice is that to hear, right? As an operator, like, this is what I like about when I just become super fans of companies who can stand there and tell you who they are not for just as well as they can tell you who they are for. And I don't know, I'm like, Fulfill.
I think their ownership structure matters.
Right now,
they have basically bootstrapped. I think they took some money at the very, very beginning, but they haven't taken all the Series A, Series B, Series C, and that allows them to grow the company at the rate that they think makes sense, where they're really able to serve customers. They don't have to hit some kind of benchmark that a VC's saying they've got to hit. And I think that makes a really tangible difference. You know, it's easy to underestimate what a superpower that is, having a really good cap table and having a leadership team that's really devoted to serving customers more than hitting some kind of arbitrary goal.
Yeah, it's business building is a human exercise for sure. And like, brands and culture, like, it's funny. They are very much top down, right? So, like, it absolutely, Mike, starts with the top person. Sean, your favorite brand ever, right? Is it James Pearse?
Yes, my favorite brand is James Pearse.
Yes, favorite brand ever. They sell t-shirts and sometimes a pool table. So that is that all ends under the, you know, his namesake brand. That to me is like, that's a person, an entrepreneur who is like, I'm just going to go explore the edges of what I want to do. And that's the brand.
Yeah. Right? The weirdest thing they have is they have a hotel in Cabo that the only way to book is to email hotelincabo@jamespearse.com. They don't have a website for it. They just have a bunch of condos just like on the coast of Mexico. And yeah, it's a guy just being like, I want to do everything I want to do. And going back to the LVMH, right? Like, you know, they own luxury. Their mission statement is to actually own beautiful things, right? Like, they own Sephora. They own like, they have companies that do as little as $15 million a year in revenue, but they're like, they're the best at what they do. And it's a beautiful experience. And it's like,
I think LVMH to me is that, and that's like, there's Kering as another one, right? Of those big European houses. They are like, if here in, and I'm going to lump Canada in, so I hope I don't offend you guys, but like, here in America, we would do well to look at how the Europeans have built consumer brands over long periods of time. And I say that because I think that, at least in this current day, like, as an entrepreneur, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but it does feel like everything is about speed, right? Mm-hmm. And how big and how fast. And if you like the AI thing right now is hilarious. it's just like, it feels like just the next version of it. But like, we conflate it all together. So like, if you're an entrepreneur, you have to be able to go fast. That's what the stories, the headlines say. If you're an entrepreneur in consumer, I actually think that one of the best qualities you could have is patience.
Matt, you're so right. And that is a lesson I need to learn is to be more patient. It is so correct for you to say that. Lululemon is the absolute best consumer brand of all time. Like, they are 25 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, oh, you're right. It was 1998. They were founded like 2 months after Google. Like, so 25 years. Took fucking forever to build that business. It's the only good one. So we have to learn that it takes forever.
This is it. It's like, there's so many, there actually are lots of great consumer brands. Lots. We just tend to forget about them because they don't make a great headline. You know, company hits $1 billion in revenue after 65 years is not a great tweet. A 20-year-old kid who's like thinking about his startup, that's not a good hook. You know, sure. He's like, I don't want to be 85 when I hit $1 billion. I like this shithead, you know, that Zuck bought, sold it in 1.2 billion in like 2 years. I want that. So it's just that when you're in consumer, calendar time matters, and it matters because the consumer psychology, just like brands take time to build, right? And brand in general is very, very closely tied to culture, along with art and music and like all those things. So you can't force a category and a brand to get bigger, faster without downside. And that downside is that like you just find the half-life of that company a lot faster. And they're just going to
There's a principle that somebody said that I loved. Technology obviously has made it possible for things to scale a lot quicker than ever before, and globalization and a lot of other things. But the principle that I saw somebody on Twitter say this, I'd attribute it, but I don't know who it was, is basically the amount of time it takes a company to get to scale is directly proportional to the amount of time it would take for it to fall. And I thought that is just such a good point. Yeah, it's the half-life. So it's like, yeah, with technology and with logistics and everything else, maybe you can scale, you can scale Prime up to, billions of dollars in sales, and you can do it in a couple of years. But guess what? It can fall out of favor just that quick. Because, and there could just as easily be a moment where it's like, oh yeah, remember in 2023 when everybody drank Prime? That was so weird. Like, the brands that we should really look up to, the business leaders we should really look up to, aren't the ones who have really impressive growth rates. They're the ones who've built things that lasted for 10, 20, 50 years. And unfortunately, we don't have a culture of doing that. That's what I was at a conference once. I was speaking at a conference. I was on a panel. And this is back when Uber and Travis were like the thing, right? This is before he gets booted, when they're growing. And people are just asking all these questions. There's somebody who actually worked at Uber on the panel, and they're just gushing about Uber and Travis. And, it was kind of a subtweet. I didn't say it directly about Uber, but I was thinking about Uber when I said it. Somebody was asking about, businesses and who do you admire? And several people on the panel just named, the flavor of the month, basically. Whoever had the fastest growth, sure, who was getting all the articles. And I just made the point that I really don't look up to anybody who hasn't been through a huge upcycle and a huge downcycle, because you learn a lot about the staying power and the quality of leader by somebody who's able to go through an extended period of time, and specifically a very trying period of time. And so the advice you're giving, Matt, like, what we should do with consumer brands is we should look at the consumer brands out there, and we should say, who are the biggest cumulative revenue, that are still, that maybe they're not growing very fast. They're growing 3% a year, but they've grown 3% a year for 40 years. Like, those are the stories where you're like, that's amazing. That's an outcome I'd love to aim at, but that's not the culture that we
That's why in. You look at Lulu. I think that's why Sean looks at Lulu. Sean, I don't know if you ever shared that, but there is a chart that shows you Lululemon's growth rate year over year over like the last 25 years. And not every year is awesome. Like, let's just say it now. Not every year is like, oof, blew the doors off that one.
Since going public, I don't think they've grown more than 30% in revenue in 1 year. And it's like, why do we keep trying to double, right? And Matt, to tie it back to an earlier statement, you said, hey, I look up to Warren Buffett, right? And everyone on Twitter, I'm going to call it Twitter specifically, talks about how great Warren Buffett is and like how they love Warren Buffett. But you're one of the few people who understands the strategy. Like Warren Buffett for fucking 50 years is like, I'm going to buy good companies at fair prices.
Yep.
And there was never financial arbitrage. There's never him getting funny or fancy. And everyone's like, he's the world's greatest investor. I'm like, he told you what he's going to do every goddamn year for the past 50 years. And he just does it. He's like, yeah, things.
It's like one of my and favorite things. It's for worth him. Saying. You ever see it where?
Go ahead, Matt.
Go for it.
I was just going to say it's worth saying that in 2020, everybody was dancing on his grave because it, you know, money was like free. And it's like, oh, Berkshire Hathaway's stupid. You know, there's a chart somebody posted. It's ARK versus the, you know, Cathie Wood's fund versus Berkshire Hathaway. And it's basically like you get to 21 and there's this massive disconnect. ARK has greatly outperformed it. And you get to today and Berkshire is up over the last 5 years over ARK. And it's just been proven. Yeah. One of the things that he said, Sean, that your quote reminded me of is he said, I want to buy businesses where I could buy it and get on a spaceship and go to the moon for 30 years and I'd come back and they'd still be selling it. You know, people are still going to be drinking Coke and people are still going to be, you know, needing insurance or whatever, or eating See's candies. And I think that kind of speaks to what you're talking about, like building an enduring brand.
It goes back to patience. It goes back to patience, right? My favorite thing ever was I saw a Warren on TV and somebody asked him to give advice to somebody else. And his advice was just live a long time. I'm really old.
Okay.
You know, like the patience thing is brilliant, right? It's like, if you like this game, like this is my thing with entrepreneurs, guys, is you really have to love it. And like in a consumer, it's like any other, you really, really have to love it. Because if you love it, you can do it for a very long time and it never feels like you're actually working. And if you can do it for a very long time and you're not a complete idiot and you don't take swings that could possibly knock you out of the game, you'll get rich.
Really proud to have Synlane as one of the sponsors of the podcast. Last week, we were in San Diego at the e-commerce roundtable that was sponsored by Synlane, and just a fantastic event. I mean, I think it really reflected exceptionally well in their leadership team, how that they ran that event. And several of the members of the Synlane team, including Jimmy, were a part of the different speaking panels. And the word that comes to mind is just thought leadership. And that's really what you want. It's not just about software. It's about the people designing and building that software and advising you on how to use that software to get the most out of your business. And the Synlane team is obviously thought leaders in the messaging space. Jimmy regularly is posting on Twitter and giving insights of how you can be more effective at communicating with your customers on own messaging. And listen, we all know CPMs are only going up. If there's a core competency you have to develop, you have to get great at messaging. And Synlane is an excellent option. We loved being there for a live operators pod. Hope everybody enjoyed listening to it. And we're thankful to have Synlane as one of our sponsors.
Yeah, I'll add for Synlane, they had the best snacks out of any event I've been to. And if you ever get a quote from Synlane, the prices are really, really low. So I don't know how they're affording these snacks. They must have like dug into their pockets and paid for them. But they threw a mean event. They got good, tasty treats there. And I've tried to invest in Synlane. Like I've tried to speak about putting your money where your mouth is. Jimmy will not let me on the cap table. I don't know why, but it's a product I believe in so much in this market that I am trying to put my own money into it. So Jimmy, this is a call for help. Let me invest in your software, dude. It's really good.
Morgan Housel. You guys familiar with Morgan Housel? He wrote The Psychology of Money. Fantastic book. Fantastic book.
Sean doesn't read books. Sean, it's okay. A great book.
It's a good book. Someone
should tweet out the highlights. No pictures. Then.
So that's these things, Sean. These are called books.
In Canada, yeah,
someone could just tweet out.
Yeah.
Just 140 characters summarizing the book. I'd love to read the tweet.
So Morgan Housel has a blog. I'm about to share from Morgan Housel's blog, which is Collab Fund. But he wrote an entire article about Buffett and about compounding. A lot of what we're talking about is the power of compounding. I don't think we've said it yet, but I'm going to say it now. Like, why is Lululemon amazing? It's not because they've blown out the sales growth in any one year. It's that they've kept doing it for decades, you know? That's why they're amazing. And anyway, the entire article is about, you know, the unbelievable power of compounding. And there's several kind of wow things he says, but this is the biggest one. As of when he wrote this, $80.7 billion of Warren Buffett's $81 billion net worth was accumulated after his 50th birthday. $78 billion of the $81 billion came after he qualified for Social Security in his mid-60s. There you go. That is unbelievable.
You know, it's so, Sean, I was talking to Brad, my business partner. We were mountain biking this weekend and out in the interior of BC. And I was mentioning you and I'm like, you know, I actually hope that Sean never gets out of consumer. I think he said that he might one day, because like, I think that there's like certain qualities that in this world, that in the consumer, like if you've got a good sense for like where culture's at, you're patient, you're not a complete cowboy. You know, for people listening to this, like these are the qualities that if you like consumer, you can do very well in it. You just need to have the patience piece.
Well, Matt, you'd be glad to know that I'm currently learning French because my new mission in life is to beat Bernard Arnault. I'm trying to kill the bastard.
Were you not here when we talked about their language police?
Yeah, like, no, I was there. Look, and you know, he did an interview. He very rarely does interviews. He did an interview where he said he will not be happy until he's the richest person on earth. He's currently number two. And he's like, yeah, I'm not, Isaac, I'm not happy. He's like, I have to be number one. And I just thought, man, I have to learn French and I have to beat that guy. It's like, I don't care about being the richest person, but I would love to beat him.
So time is on your side, not his.
Yeah, that's true.
You got 60 years. Old Bernie, he doesn't.
Yeah. So I'm coming for him.
Amazing.
Well, dude, that was a good tangent. Matt, take it away. What's part two?
Do we want to do a part two? We've been going for 50 minutes just on these things.
I think that's a good episode. I think we just saved the personalization thing I think there's a lot of offshoots to that. This was great, guys. Good conversation.
Yeah.